It's showtime.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people.
You know, the right to bear arms is because that's the last form of defense against tyranny.
Washington is fundamentally corrupt. There are more words in the IRS code than there are in the Bible.
Made in America, heard around the world. You're listening to Blunt Force Truth. I'm Chuck Woolery, along with my co-host, Mark Young, and we're here to do nothing but serve you and inform you and let you know what's going on, break down the headlines, and investigate the truth. Hi, Mark. Well,
How are you doing, brother?
Sad over this situation in Florida, like everyone else. Our hearts go out to these people. It's you know, the thing that really strikes me is that everyone has an idea. No one wants to come to grips with how to solve this really. And one of the glaring things is that you and I both know this. Our audience, by and large, knows this, that every one of these attacks take place in a gun-free zone. I don't know who came up with the feely, touchy, good feely about the gun-free zone, but it is the bane of our existence. I think that these school boards everywhere should get together and arm men to stand around these schools and guard them and guard our children, because there are evil people out there who will do evil things, and there's no way to stop them except using the same force that they come at you with. And I just don't get why we are so hell-bent on look, let's say you could stop these things by collecting every gun in the United States. Fine.
There's only 360 million of them.
It's not going to work. So forget that argument. Trey Gowdy said something this morning that I thought was very interesting. He says, show me a bill. Give me a law that will protect us from this, and I'll sign it today. The fact is that there are evil people doing evil things, and a gun-free zone is a soft target, and they know it, and that's where they come and they shoot people. So stop it. Arm people and put them in the way of those people so that they have to go through someone to get to these children. I mean, it's just ridiculous to me. I'm frustrated with it. I really am.
The average,
it may be a partial answer, but at least it's something that works.
The average mass shooting that is stopped by a police officer has something like 12 or 14 deaths. Mm-hmm. The average mass shooting that is stopped by a legally armed citizen has less than two deaths.
Well, the point is there should be a point of resistance for anyone who wants to do harm to these children in any way, in any fashion, and they should be well-armed and should be guarding these schools.
Yeah, a gun-free zone should be correctly titled as a target-rich environment.
Of course, and the point is you and I have talked about this ad infinitum, and other people talk about it, not just us, but no one seems to. You see, the gun-free zone thing is like one of those fake, you feel good. Oh, I'm in a gun-free zone, so I'm fine. No, you're not.
Because the criminal doesn't, you know, here's the thing that's ridiculous. If someone's going to go out with the intent of shooting as many people as they can, what's the odds that they're going to respect your gun-free zone law?
No, they're not. That's the point. It's a gun-free zone makes you more vulnerable than any particular place on the planet, as far as I'm concerned.
I mean, it's an insane concept, because murder is against – where did the gun-free zone come from?
Where did that originate?
I thought that came – didn't that come out of the Brady Bill?
I have no – maybe.
I think it came out of the Brady Bill.
It is just insane. I mean,
our engineer, Matt, who is in the booth, he might know, or he might be able to look that up and fill us in on it, but – the concept is ridiculous. The majority of mass shootings happen in gun-free zones, as you're pointing out.
Right.
You cannot blame police, because in a best case scenario, in a fabulous scenario, the police show up in 3 or 4 minutes. How many people can you shoot in 3 or 4 minutes? You can wreak havoc.
And they do. They do wreak havoc.
But anyway, when you have somebody armed who's on the ground,
I can bring it to
a stop.
I think this whole gun-free zone thing it's just about feelings. It's about how you feel and whether you feel safe and all of that. And it literally is, it's impractical. It doesn't function on the level of protecting you in any way.
Well, feelings is the liberal platform for everything, though.
Well, I know, and that's why I pointed that out.
All right, Chuck, so you were just asking about where did the gun-free zone come from, and
I'm going to guess. I'm going to guess that it was a Democrat. I just have to guess it.
Well, you would be guessing right. Matt in the booth went and looked it up for us. It was introduced to the Senate in 1990 by guess, Joe Biden.
Of course, the man with shotgun.
Shotgun Joe. Creepy, grabby shotgun Joe.
Golly. Oh, man. And I'm sure that would be the time of the elder Bush. So he probably signed it into law, right?
And it was signed by Bush 41, who, I don't care how you cut it, Bush 41.
His friends.
He was an absolute globalist.
Yeah. There's no question about it.
So the Republicans, not all Republicans are defenders of the Second Amendment.
No, not all Republicans are the same. That's for sure.
Not all Republicans are conservative. But,
you know, that said, and I do this a lot on Twitter, and I know you do too. We rail against the Republicans when they're wrong and we don't agree with them. Republicans are anti-conservatives. I understand all of that. I'm saying the establishment Republicans are anti-conservative. So I understand all that. And yet at the same time, I will stress and say that I would rather have these people in authority in Congress and as president than the absolute progressive Marxist left. And it's a bad choice, but it's the only choice we have until we can clean up the Republican Party, which certainly could happen in the future.
Well, what I've said before is the baseline Republicans are shuffling us toward socialism. The current baseline Democrats want to jog.
Well, it's like, you know, the rank and file Democrat voter is not like the leadership.
No.
It's like the rank and file FBI was not like the leadership. The rank and file DOJ is not like the leadership. So it's the leadership we have most of these problems. In fact, it's where we have all of these problems.
We have a guest, by the way, not today, but we have a guest coming up in the next couple of weeks, Chuck, when you just mentioned that. We have an actual FBI supervisor who's going to be on, and he's going to really give people the inside scoop on what's going on. So listen for that show.
Awesome.
Another week or two from now. Now, the next thing that I'm sure is going to happen is they're reporting that he had an AR-15-like gun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I don't know what an AR-15-like gun is.
Well, obviously, a gun that looks like an AR-15, but may not be that designated firearm.
But, I mean, the reality is, and most of our audience know this, an AR-15 is a small, it's a varmint hunting or target gun. It's a hunting rifle, right, with a pistol grip and a sight.
Yeah.
So it looks frightening.
You know, this drives me nuts because this has nothing to do with the situation. It could be a truck, a giant semi run into a classroom. I mean, it could be anything. So the weapon that's used is always what the left comes out and talks about. But they never want to talk about the evil of the person and how they can be stopped. We always have this giant psychoanalysis that goes on with these people. There were warnings sent up. The FBI got warnings, and yet no one followed through. And it's always hindsight. They look back and go, well, you know, we can't really hold him for something that he didn't do. Well, then, you know, pass a law about writing things on the internet. Maybe that'll start it. He put these things on an internet. He was going to be a school shooter. Put him under arrest for that. I don't know. I don't know what the answer to all those ancillary things are. But the point is, he was known by everyone in school, it seems, and no one would do anything about it. No one would speak up. So that's kind of where we live today, isn't it? We're afraid. We accuse everybody of everything on Twitter and Facebook and Snapchat and all of these other things. But we never really accuse anybody where it makes a difference.
Now, had he gone out and made those threats and said he was a Trump supporter, they probably would have went after him. This probably wouldn't have happened.
Maybe. I don't know. They would have gone.
But anyway. Yeah, but we can't go after people like this. Now, the next thing that I'm expecting to see is, and here's the thing. Everybody is falling into this AR-15-like weapon. Even Fox News is making the AR-15-like weapon a headline. Mm-hmm. The rifle doesn't matter.
Oh, how many times have we been down this road, Mark?
I could give you any rifle and you could do the same amount of damage. Having a pistol grip on the rifle doesn't really make that big of an advantage.
But how many times have we been down this road over and over again? And still, I still say the first line of defense is are people, depending on the size of the school, are people with weapons standing there protecting? I guarantee you, if there are two houses next to each other and one guy has a weapon and an alarm system and the other guy doesn't, guess where the crook's going to go? It's just so simple to me.
And here's the thing. We don't have enough police officers to guard all these schools.
Well, there are lots of people who could guard that. They don't have to be police officers.
I believe that there are legally licensed patriotic Americans in most every city who would probably take shifts and volunteer walking their school or standing outside of their children's school.
Well, this is a serious job. I mean, this is not like being a, you know, nighttime guard at Walmart or someplace like that. This is definitely a serious job, and they have to be well trained to do it, I believe. And it seems like no one wants to make the investment in that because, oh, it looks bad to have someone with a gun, an armed uniformed officer with a gun at a school. Well, I'm sorry.
Now, we have a bill, I think.
Let me go a little bit further on that. Are you saying that it looks bad so you don't want it and you'll put your children at risk because you don't want something that looks bad to you? I mean, give me a break.
We've got a bill that's in the House here in Michigan. I think it's still in committee at the moment, but it's to take Michigan CPL holders and to require them to go through, I think, an additional 7 hours of training. Mm-hmm. And if they go through the additional training, they now can carry into gun-free zones.
Well, I don't think that would have helped these schools because they're soft targets. Just being able to carry in a gun-free zone is not going to answer this. What's going to answer it is having guards on schools, guards who have teeth, who have guns, who can intercept anyone who wants to come on that campus and do harm. That's where it has to go. And if it doesn't go there, we're just going to continue to see these things happen over and over and over again because there are evil people who want to do evil things for reasons that you and I can't even calculate.
It would certainly make for a terrific jobs program for ex-military.
I was going to say on our unemployed veterans, you have an entire workforce that would chomp at the bit to get a chance there.
Absolutely, they do, Matt. You're right. Thank you for that, interjecting that, because it's absolutely right. That's our
and Matt's former military, so I mean he's very familiar with that. Right. But yeah, I think there would be a whole group of people that are willing to take those jobs.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
What kind of AR-15 like weapon was used in the Boston Marathon killings?
That was a bomb.
Oh, that's right. That was a pressure cooker.
Sorry.
Well, that was a pressure cooker that resembled pressure cookers used in the military.
What?
Stop. Well, it was a frightening looking pressure cooker.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, the reality is we've got lots of people that would jump in. And
we say this, we talk about this over and over. Every time there's a school shooting, no matter how great or small it is, there's never a really small one. We still talk about this over and over again, and nothing is done, where it seems so obvious to me that what is wrong with our legislators that they can't come to an agreement on something like this? I just don't understand it.
I'm going to answer this question for you with one of your own comments.
Oh, dear.
Why is DACA not resolved?
Because they don't want to resolve it?
Correct.
So you think that they don't want to resolve this?
No. I don't believe the liberals have the liberals in power, I don't believe, have the slightest bit of interest in resolving this problem.
Well, that's more sad than anything, if that's true.
Because this is, think about it. They get to capture the headlines today.
True.
Saying that pro-Second Amendment people are barbarians. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I get that.
Why would you fix it? Because imagine if the headline was, wayward teenager attempts to shoot up school and is stopped by ex-military guard at the door. What kind of headline would that be?
Awesome.
It would be for us, but how would that help the liberal agenda?
It should be for everyone. That's what the point is.
But we already know, Chuck, that we have We have
this nation, and we're under attack. I know that.
This is a group of people who are willing to sacrifice human life. They are willing to sacrifice the truth. They are willing to sacrifice each other when necessary to move their agenda.
Well, that's a tough ends to justify the means, or means to justify the ends.
So anything new on your front as far as the FISA memo?
No, other than, you know, everybody's putting together dots and trying to figure out what's going on with this thing. It's the more complicated the press can make it, the more difficult it is for people to understand it. My problem is this, is that if you're getting your news from the mainstream media, you don't even know what the FISA report is. You have no idea what the FISA report is. It's true. You don't know who any of these people are. You don't know anything. So if you're getting your news from the mainstream media, it's being portrayed in a completely different way. It's propagandized. It's just terrible what's going on. I mean, it really is. The news today is to take facts and reshape them, rejigger them to suit their own political means. And it's propaganda is all it is. It's just propaganda. And one of these days, we're going to get to the end of this. Maybe. I don't know when. I have no idea. The inspector general, everybody keeps saying wait on his report. But in the past, inspector generals really never have indicted or come up with indictable kinds of things that I can recall. So I don't know whether I have much faith in that or not. But I know this, it continues to unravel and the left continues to deceive.
I think it's what drives me crazy when the liberals came out, the Democrats came out, and said that President Trump would be irresponsible if he released the 4-page memo because it would uncover national security secrets, which it had none, which he released. Then they wrote a 10-page memo that they peppered throughout.
With sources.
With top secret methods and information about national security.
Just to make it look bad, so they'd have to redact it. And then claim it was something else.
And that's it in a nutshell.
That's it in a nutshell, exactly.
They put the president in a position where the president had to make a decision on did he want to protect the nation and protect national security, or did he want to release the memo?
Democrats.
Right. So now, and he did the right thing. I'm glad he didn't redact it.
So am I. So am I.
I'm glad he sent it back to them and said, go do it correctly. Mm-hmm. Now, you notice that they haven't run to the White House with a corrected version yet.
No, they'll milk this as long as they possibly can.
They can't write a corrected version.
Yeah, no, I know.
That's the problem. How do you write this thing? How do you spin this thing? Because remember, we're not talking about a news story now. We're talking about a congressional memo.
Let's do spin and then reverse spin. Here's the spin. The Trump dossier was intelligence. That's the first spin that the FBI, the DOJ, the CIA, everybody put on this, that it was intelligence. The reverse spin, which is the truth, is it was opposition research, which could not be validated and to this day still can't be validated. Carter Page, who at one time worked for the FBI and actually put Russians in jail, And on top of that, he's been under investigation since 2012, I believe. Why isn't he in handcuffs?
Because they've got nothing. There's
exactly.
Nothing wrong with him.
So,
but you're right.
I'm telling you, mainstream media people don't know this story. They don't know anything about it.
How do you not know it? I mean, they took
because they don't tell it. That's how. It's just they just don't talk about it.
And people need to understand, and I'm sure, again, our audience does, that Hillary's campaign paid to make the dossier out of lies that they fed to Christopher Steele.
From Blumenthal, Sidney Blumenthal, from the Russians.
They paid the Russians
for it. I mean, give me a break. It's right there in front of us. I think it's one of the reasons our audience and that you and I and people on the right are looking at this, and we are so incredibly frustrated. Because the answer, it's like watching Wheel of Fortune. And since I was the host of Wheel of Fortune, I can identify with this. It's exactly the audience watching the Wheel of Fortune. There's two things that happen. And I didn't realize this until we were well into the show, why it was so successful. Number one, the audience always has the answer first. They always do.
Well, they're not under pressure.
One person instead of three people.
Yeah, and they're not under any stress either.
No. And so they always have the answer first, and they're saying to the people, why can't you get this? I've got it. And yep. This is what's happening with this. Why can't you get this? I've got it. We know the answer. I mean, the people know the answer. The government seems to be going, well, I don't know. You know, it could be over here. Just frustrating.
So on today's show, Chuck, we're going to have someone on our show who is opposed to us.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So we don't always, you know, a lot of times we have people on and they are of similar mind and share our beliefs in freedom and a strong country. So this is Professor Richard D. Wolf. He's a very nice guy. Mm-hmm. He is from the University of Massachusetts, mm-hmm. and he believes that the way that we do business in America is wrong, that we need to follow a new model of doing business. I'll let people judge for themselves, you know, what.
And don't get mad at us. We don't press him too hard. You'll be able, and what we like to do is leave a little hole every now and let you press him. You know the answer.
Yeah. I mean, here's the idea, folks. I'm going to tell you what Chuck just said. We challenged him. We questioned him in this interview. But what we were trying not to be was to be the identity politics, the name calling, the rude, you know, you're stupid, you're a fool kind of thing.
We think and we wanted smart enough to figure this out.
We wanted to have an honest conversation with the guy because, you know what? We need to know these things. As conservatives, we have to make sure that we don't put ourselves in a bubble just like they do. Right. So as they're listening to all of their propaganda and they're only hearing what they think is the truth, we need to make sure that we're listening to what they hear and what they think too, because we can't prepare for it if we don't understand it.
And so our guest today is?
Chuck, we are welcoming, and I'm going to say Dr. Richard Wolf. Now, he's already corrected me and said he doesn't use the doctor because it's a reward that he got for spending 10 years sitting on his butt in a little chair, I believe he said.
Yes.
But anyways, I'm going to welcome you as Dr. Richard Wolf. And as we've already, you know, kind of prefaced people, he is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts. He's a Harvard grad, a Stanford grad, a Yale man. It's like, wow, what a pedigree.
No kidding. Yeah, that's quite a pedigree, Richard. It really is.
Yes, I like to wave it around. Whenever I get myself into trouble and people start looking at me funny, I wave the pedigree and it works a little bit like garlic with the devil, you know?
Yeah. I do the exact same thing, but I use a 9mm.
Yes, probably works better.
So Richard, let me ask you a question. For our audience, it's kind of, we start with the very basics. We're kind of simple people here. I'm certainly simple. I'm not an economist, not by any stretch of the imagination, but I understand a little bit about the economy. So let's go from a premise of what you are and where you come from. Are you a Keynesian person or are you Austrian? What school do you kind of, you know, favor?
Well, it's a great question. I wish the question were asked of me more often.
Oh, good. Well, my simplicity is absolutely reward.
It's actually very sophisticated, and I tell you why. Every economist comes from somewhere, has some loyalty, some commitment, some ideological, and that's fine. I have no problem with it. But it would be better for an audience to know.
Exactly.
And you have to know where it comes from. Right. So let me give you a slightly long-winded, I'll try not to be too much so, answer.
Oh, it's yes or no.
Yeah. Like a lawyer.
He was simple, didn't he? Okay, sophisticated questions that require very simplistic answers.
I had to learn, when I was going to school, the convention of economics at the time. And since I went to those elite schools, I was taught by the famous professors who did this sort of thing what it was we were supposed to learn. And we basically learned at that time two ways of thinking. One is called neoclassical economics, and that would be basically the mainstream tradition in which private...
Which you would call what? Name it, the mainstream tradition.
Well, it's called, in the profession, it's called neoclassical economics. That's what it's called.
How would the average person refer to it? How would they be able to tackle
it? Think of it as a celebration of free markets, free enterprise, as the royal road to efficiency, growth, and the greatest happiness for the greatest number.
So you would call that capitalism?
Yeah, it's a celebration of capitalism. It always was, and that's what it is. The second school we learned was the school which is called Keynesianism. It came out of the 1930s when the capitalist economy around the world crashed, and you had a new way of thinking which basically said capitalism is really pretty good, but periodically falls apart. And when it does, you need something to come in and fix it, and that's the government. And if the government comes in and does the right thing, which Mr. Keynes worked out, well, then we'll get the best of everything. We'll have the good stuff of capitalism and the government preventing the bad stuff from getting us into trouble. And that's what I learned. And so in a sense, I was equipped to teach either the mainstream or the Keynesian, or what was usually in most universities and is still today, a little bit of both, usually tilting more to the mainstream, but including a few courses on the Keynes.
That is shocking to me.
It is.
No, I seriously shocking to me. I would think that it would lean far more toward the Keynesian.
Not at all.
Now, where would the Austrian school be?
When I was a student at Yale, Harvard, and Stanford, probably was the high point of the Keynesians. They were the dominant ones. That was true then. But with Reagan and Thatcher in England, that came to an end. The Keynesians had been nasty. They had, you know, ridiculed the tradition for being naive and blind and unaware of the problems of capitalism. So they had given them a rough ride, deprived many of them of promotions and so forth within the profession. And so when the wind shifted, when the Keynesians fell out of favor in the 1970s, 80s particularly, the neoclassicals came back in, the celebrators of capitalism, and they were at least as nasty to the Keynesians as they came in, as the Keynesians had been against them a couple of decades earlier.
Would it be oversimplifying to say that Keynesian is primarily a state economic model, that is government model, as opposed to a free market model, which capitalism would be? Am I oversimplifying those two?
Yeah, a little. Because most of the Keynesians that I've ever met, most of them, not all of them, but most of them.
Most of them I've ever met don't believe in Keynesianism.
Yeah, well, a good number of them basically are happy with capitalism. They're not critics of capitalism. What they say is that if you leave, their basic pitch is this. If you leave capitalism to itself, the private capitalist economy, it is going to produce over time its own enemies in such a way that it would be foolish to let it go until it self-destructs.
So let capitalism hang itself.
Yes, exactly. And so we Keynesians, these majority of them say, we have the solution. We have the kinds of government interventions, as I said before, that will get us the capitalism and the good results we think go with that without the self-destructive tendencies. Okay. And so they claim that they are better protectors of capitalism than the celebrators are. In other words, they'll be a better basis for keeping capitalism going than the people who claim to be the champions of capitalism.
So this has been around since the 30s.
Exactly.
Is it Paul Keynes?
John Maynard Keynes.
Yeah, John Maynard
Keynes, right. So it's been around since the 30s. I remember that I was told that there was an article in Reader's Digest that was made for the American public that warned and said, don't do this. This is a very bad system. But it was in Reader's Digest, like, you know, three or four pages, an article in it.
Right.
Which was, I guess, the paper of note back then. But we're able to really have a historical view of both systems and how they perform. So how does the Keynesian, I'm going to call it socialist kind of system, perform as opposed to the capitalist system over the last 70 years, 80 years?
I wish it were easy to answer, because people who are Keynesians disagree amongst themselves. Not to say that the others don't, everybody does, but the Keynesians, for example, a good number of them would stop you right away and say, no, we're not statist. We don't believe in state, and we certainly are not socialist, heaven forbid. We love capitalism, but...
Democrats have been saying that for years.
Yes. So, I mean, it, for them, they don't think there's another system. They just think they're fixing the weaknesses, the rough edges, if you like, of capitalism. Mm-hmm. So that's all they're doing. They're not doing more.
But where would you put Bernie Sanders in that?
No, I think he goes a little bit further, because he wants that word socialism. Okay. My teachers of Keynesianism, let me give you an example. At Yale, my teacher was a man named James Tobin, who eventually got a Nobel Prize in economics, a pretty famous guy. Mm-hmm. He's passed away, but he was my teacher. He would have never accepted the word socialism if it had been uttered in the classroom. He would have, his hair would have stood on end, and he would have spent the rest of the hour explaining to us how and why he never was, is not now, and never plans to be a socialist. No, he didn't want any of that. But there are Keynesians who do take it the next step. That's why your question is complicated. Who do say, it's not only that the state should come in when capitalism has rough edges and goes in a self-destructive direction. Actually, the state should come in all the time and be a kind of partner, let's call it, to the private capitalist system, because that kind of partnership is a way better way to run the economy than to have it primarily private.
So
those kinds of Keynesians might be more comfortable with some kind of socialism attached to them as well.
Let me see if I can use words that perhaps people can latch onto a little easier. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, because I could be, obviously. So when you talk about state coming in, government coming in and controlling things, now you're talking about a regulatory kind of situation where they regulate
right.
the economy, correct? So absolutely. Now in today's world, here comes Trump into the world and deregulates all kinds of things, and the economy goes bang.
Well, I mean, right now, the last few days, it's going bang in the wrong direction. But
yeah, but that's it. It's always correcting back and forth. I mean, let's be honest with each other. It's. I mean, how many? Let's look at the last year. And again, I'm not an economist. I'm not an expert. I'm just somebody who observes and looks. And I have a couple of stocks. The stock market went up. How many thousand points did it go up in the last year?
Quite a few.
Well, how many?
How many did it go up?
6,000? 5,000?
9,000?
More like that. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. 9,000 in the last year. In the last couple of weeks, it went down 1,100. And everybody's hair's on fire.
Yeah, because they're afraid that it's the beginning of...
The giant correction.
That's right. That's right. And, there's as much argument for that as there is...
Shouldn't it?
Let me go back to your more important question there.
Okay.
Absolutely right. Trump is a deregulator. Before that, the Keynesians are big regulators.
And Reagan was a deregulator as
right.
well.
Reagan was a deregulator. And in some ways, the Bushes and Clinton, too, were deregulators, actually more than they regulated.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the problem. The regulations were promised to people in America as means to a better economic situation. Mm-hmm. We got the regulations, but we didn't get the better economic situation. But the reason the regulators came in to regulate was in the prior deregulated situation. That didn't work out real well either. At a certain point, the American people are going to look at each other and say, we've been fighting the wrong battle. It isn't regulation versus deregulation, because we've tried all that. We've been there. We've done it. And the one leads into the other, because we keep thinking that the one is going to get us what the other one didn't, but they don't. Which means you maybe ought to be asking whether there are different kinds of changes that ought to happen, rather than an endless debate between more government versus less government, when the fact of the matter is most Americans weren't thrilled by the regulatory regime, they weren't thrilled by the deregulation that preceded it, and my guess is they're not going to be thrilled by the deregulation we're going through now either.
I'll go one step further and say most Americans have no clue about any of that.
Professor,
I guess I disagree.
Unfortunately.
I think they have feelings about it. They have glimpses into it.
Professor, you said something earlier that I wanted to bring you back to, and you said that the Keynesian model of economics requires government to step in when needed and to do the right thing.
Yes.
What's the odds on government doing the right thing?
Ever.
That's a very profound critique of Keynesianism. And you know, John Maynard Keynes was a professor. He was a professor at Cambridge University in England. And even though he was very active and he was a policymaker, he advised British governments and he helped write the UN economic arrangements at the end of World War II and
was
all of
an
that.
Investor?
Yes. Yes. But what Keynes was a professor. And you have here an example of a problem of professors. They come up with a system and a model of how to fix it. But that's very nice, and it might even work. But in the world as it is, it's going to be hedged about by all of the vested interests of a capitalist system. The industries, the state governments, the local governments, foreign interests, and between what a nice model they make up in the classroom and what actually gets done in the state capitals and in the federal capitals, there's a big difference. And the problem has been that the Keynesianism actually enacted has not worked anywhere near as well as the models had said it could and it would, leading to an interminable literature and debate in which one or another force gets blamed for this. The problem is, you know, the real world is the real world. Industries that are desperate to make money are going to be doing it. And they're not going to be worried about this or that policy. They're going to go in there and get their friends in government to help them in exchange for the campaign contributions and all the rest.
Yeah, so the human element.
Exactly. The problem I've always had with Keynesian economics is it was literally laboratory created. And there doesn't seem to be any way for accounting for human behavior and the thousands of different behaviors around the world and how people will react. And I think it also takes into account that people are always going to react the same way. And they don't always react the same way.
They never do, in fact. They're always shifting and changing as we go through life. But let me assure you that the exact same problem applies to conventional neoclassical economics, which also has a model which it believes governs what happens in the factory, the office, or the store, and human nature being what it is. That doesn't work out real well either, which is why we don't have the lovely private capitalist economy that we teach students exists somewhere out there, but when they ask us honestly, tell me exactly where that is, the honest professor says it isn't. What you have is a complicated, messy, vague approximation to all of that, and that's the same problem that the Keynesians have.
Why do you think the left is so virulent about anti-capitalism? Because they are. I mean, they have marches, they talk about capitalism being the demon of the bane of existence in government and private enterprise. They're just constantly, they do not want anything to do with capitalism, down with capitalism. What is that all about?
Yeah, very good question. That's really like what I was trying to say a few minutes ago. What we have now is a generation of people of all ages that has been through, in a sense, too much. It has been through the growth after World War II. It has been through the stagnation since the 1970s. They have been promised this or that economic well-being. They have been told their well-being is on a secure foundation if they have it. And they've basically been disappointed. They've been disappointed by the regulatory regime, say from 1945 to 75. And they've been disappointed in different ways by the deregulatory regime, say, since Reagan and through Trump. And so you're getting a larger and larger number of people who are basically saying, we don't want to spend a lot of effort and time arguing more state, more private, less private, more regulated. We've been there, we've done that. That's not addressing our problem. And the way they say that is to say the system itself, not this or that version of it, not this or that form of it, but the system, it's, there's something more fundamentally wrong. And that, of course, frightens the people who hadn't thought like that before. But for me, I think it's very healthy. I think we should have been debating our economic system for the last half a century, and that we're the poorer as a country for not having done that. You know, we're good as America.
If we can, Professor, let's pick up on some of these new models you're talking about. We're going to take a quick break right now. Sure. And we're going to come right back to hearing about the new models.
You know, let's take a little break here. I want to talk about Dermend. Dermend is like one of the great products, skin products for people my age, the over 50 maybe. They have a great itch product. They have an unbelievable bruise product. These things, these lotions are, you know, basically one of them's coconut oil. They're fabulous lotions to begin with. But they also do things that are just amazing for your skin. Just they help it look younger, more youthful, get rid of all those blotches and prevent, you know, all these, this heavy bruising that I get on my arms because of the medication that I have to take. And so many of us do have to take. So it's a great preventative and it's a great maintenance lotion to use.
You're right, Chuck. Dermend is a great line. There's three products. And I'm going to tell you, Dermend has a lot of very expensive products in these formulas. There's three products. There's the anti-bruise product or the bruise relief product, which you use, and your arms right. look freaking amazing now. Like I said, they used to look like you were an MMA fighter.
And, that's true.
And now they don't. There's the anti-itch product, which you can use, of course, if you have an itch product. But the anti-itch product is amazing because as we get older, we start to develop these chronic itches. And you can use this product every day. And you can't use other itch formulas every day because they have hydrocortisone in it, which thins the skin. Yeah. And Dermend has products that help thicken the skin. And then the last item, and I really think this is really one for the ladies, to be honest with you, and that's that fragile skin. And that's the one, no matter what you do, you can get a facelift, you can get Botox, you can do whatever you want to do on your face. You can't make your hands look younger. And this product does.
Yeah.
And it's an awesome product. So, folks, try it out. Walgreens, Walmart, CVS, Rite Aid. Look for it. In most stores, you will find it in the first aid section. So it's Dermend.
So here we are. We have new models that we're going to talk about.
Yes.
Are they a combination of capitalism and whatever? Keynesian?
Well,
what are they? Because that's certainly where we are today in the United States. We are from my point of view, we are a mixed economy. Mixed economy.
Yep. And I think that mix is about to change and probably fairly profoundly, because the old mix is just not satisfying enough people to be secure. I mean, and that happens in history, and I don't find that terribly scary. I think that's a sign that we're about to go through some fairly big changes. Let me just explain what I think is coming down the pike. I think the problem is going to be focused on not the government at all, more or less of it, but rather on how workplaces are organized. By that I mean the factory, the office, the store, the three major ways that we organize the production and distribution of goods and services. We now have a particular way of doing that. Most of the goods and services in America are produced by an entity called a corporation. And it's really important to look at that, because the way that's done is, I think, what's going to change. The current way is typically the following. There are shares of stock. The ownership is distributed through the stock market. People buy a share of stock and they get a piece of the ownership of a company that runs the office or the store or the factory or some combination of them. These shares entitle the owner to a vote. One share, one vote. You have 10 shares, you get 10 votes. You have 1 million shares, you get 1 million votes. Once a year, that's the law in this society and in most capitalist societies, once a year, the shareholders vote for a group of people called the board of directors. That's usually 12 to 20 people in most corporations, and you vote for them. And again, you get one vote per share that you own.
And let me interrupt you just for a second for our audience. The professor speaking about, obviously, publicly held companies.
Right.
Not privately held companies. Right. Go ahead, Professor. I'm sorry.
The privately held short circuits it all, because an individual or a family or a small group substitute for shareholders and board of directors. They're that. But again, the corporation is the dominant institution. And so the shareholders, and it's important to remember that roughly 1% of shareholders own 2/3 of the shares. In other words, that 1% controls most corporations in the sense that it elects the board of directors. These 12 to 20 people, the board of directors, make the key decisions of every corporation. And by that I mean they decide what the company is going to produce. They decide how the company is going to carry out that production, the technology and all that. Number three, they decide where the production is going to happen. Is it going to happen in San Antonio or is it going to happen in Shanghai, China? That kind of question. And finally, and probably most importantly, it's the board of directors that decides what to do with the profits or the net revenues that the company as a whole generates through what everybody contributes in the way of work at that place for the year, say. So the board of directors makes all the key decisions. If you want to understand how and why the capitalist system we live in generates the results we are living with, then you have to begin by saying, these are the people, this is how they get into the position of being able to make those decisions. And now comes the hard part. Are those decisions accountable? In other words, do the people affected by those decisions participate in making them? I call that democracy. It's what we do in our political life, right? If I live in Austin, Texas, I have the right as a citizen to vote for the people who make those political decisions, the mayor, the governor, and all that. And the idea is they make decisions that impact me. I've got to have some power over them. And that's why we're not a kingdom or a monarchy or something, because we give the people power over the decision makers whose decisions affect them. We don't do that in our economic life. The board of directors is not accountable. Let's say at General Motors, the board of directors is 12 people or 15 people. They are not accountable to the 200,000 employees of General Motors.
But they're accountable to the stockholders, are they not?
What?
They're accountable to the stockholders.
The board of directors is accountable to the 1% of the stockholders.
Well, I mean,
1% of stockholders is less than 1% of the population.
So but it's not 1% of who owns that company, though. They're responsible for the people who own the majority of the company. So I think where Chuck's going here is the board of directors are, in many cases, the board of directors could be stockholders, and they could be major stockholders. So I think what we're asking here is, aren't they accountable? Inside. Right. Aren't they accountable to the people who own the stock, not the people who work at the company? Because people who own the stock are the people who are taking the risk.
Well, let's go step by step. First of all, accountable means if you don't do what they like, you're not going to be there very much longer, like in an election. All you have to do is win the election.
So you're saying the minority controls the majority.
Right. If 1% of the people, shareholders, own 2/3 of the shares, That's the people you've got to please. You can displease the others, but as long as you please the 1%, your job is secure, and the decisions you make in that job will get reproduced. So in the fact of the matter is, we don't apply the democratic standard. We don't subject the board of directors to being elected by the people whose lives they shape. I mean, for example, let's be real blunt. If a board of directors of 15 people decides to close a Ford factory in Tennessee and move it to Mexico, which they do, then the people of Tennessee are affected. But their ability to shape that decision by a vote for or against this board of directors, that doesn't exist. They have no such power, directly or indirectly. They can't do that.
But how do you stop advocating for a change to that process? And
absolutely.
Now, how do you stop those people in Tennessee from voting to keep the plant, even though the plant's losing money?
Under our law, they can't do that. First of all, the people...
What I'm saying, under your model, if the workers were able to vote on the board of directors,
right?
The board of directors said, let's close this plant because we can make this cheaper in Mexico and this plant is not making money.
Right.
The workers are going to vote to keep the plant open because it's their jobs.
Probably.
And now the company's losing money, so now you ruin the company.
It's possible. Here's another option. The workers say the cost to us and to the larger community here in Tennessee is larger than the gain in profit you get from moving to Mexico. So by keeping you here, we diminish your profit, say by $100 million, but we avoid social costs here in Tennessee of $200 million if we let you move. So for the society as a whole, this is a better deal to keep you here than to move you there, because the benefit, which goes to the shareholders who get the profit, is less than the cost to us from having you move. And under those circumstances, in economics, we teach you shouldn't move, because it's the society as a whole which represents what we want.
But why would I invest in that company? That's a bad investment.
Hang on just a second. Hang on. That's really just jumping off the page at me. And that is, now you get back to government, because government normally, by overregulation, causes problems within companies to... it's a negative effect. They normally lose money because of overregulation of the government. So they'll move to a government or a place where there's less regulation and they can make more money.
They've been doing that for 30 years. That's right. They've been leaving in droves.
So Trump is now, just as an example, and I guess Reagan did the same thing to a certain extent. I'm not sure. I've heard many people who were in the Reagan administration applauding Trump, saying he's better than Reagan. So I don't know. It's still, the night is young. We'll see how this progresses. But he is deregulating, saying, you know, come back to the United States. We're taking all these onerous regulations off you. We're not going to tax you like the government has taxed you before. We're going to make you a more profitable institution here in the United States than you can make over there. It's going to be better for everybody, including the American people. So this now comes back down to not the board of directors, but a government decision.
Well, it's not either or. The decisions are made by the board of directors, and they are affected, of course, by government policy.
Affected by government policy, wouldn't you say?
No, it's only really a small part. Let me give you an example. Let's take what you picked out. Mr. Trump is going to, he did already, cut the taxes on corporations. Right. Corporate profits tax went down from 35% to 21%, exactly as you say, with the rationale, just as you say.
And the regulations behind that.
And the regulations that go with it. But now let me explain to you what that's going to mean, because it isn't going to mean what Mr. Trump promises, for the same reason that we didn't get what Obama promised, or Clinton promised, or Bush promised, or Reagan promised. The minute the rest of the world understood what Mr. Trump was going to do, they began doing the same thing. The crazy thing that's happening in this country is that Americans, who are perfectly smart people, are not putting their heads together right. What do you think the rest of the world is going to do about its regulations when we reduce them here? about their taxes when we reduce them here? Let me answer my own question.
They'll have to compete.
Exactly, and they've already done so. The Europeans are cutting their taxes. The Israelis are cutting their taxes. The Chinese are cutting their taxes.
Why is it bad?
You know what we're going to get? We're going to get a vastly reproduced version of just what we had, because you can't play that game under the illusion that you're the only one who makes moves. That's childish. That's a desire of people to believe a magic bullet is going to come in there and just fix everything.
I want to bring you back to your corporation here for a minute.
Yeah, let's go back to that.
So I have two questions for you. One, why would an investor invest in a public corporation? Because I'm listening to this and I'm like, well, I just wouldn't get involved in a public corporation. I would just get involved in private. The second thing is, if the workers are making the votes, and I'm going to give you a real world example here in Detroit in the past. So General Motors decides we're going to close a plant in Detroit and we're going to open a plant in Alabama.
Right.
So the Detroit workers are going to vote no. The Alabama workers are going to vote yes. So now who's running the board of directors?
Right. Here's what you'd have to do. Let's do step by step. First, you'd have to work out some kind of arrangement between the Detroits and the Alabamas. And the reason the Alabamas might be open to that is they don't want to be Detroit 2 years down the road. In other words, they have an interest, too, to work out a system. Otherwise, they're going to be the loser, just like Detroit is now the risk of the loser. And my guess is they'll come up with ways of handling that. Now let me tell you why you might want to invest in a company run by the workers. And this is very American. I can show you that studies are there. They're all available. I can show you that when workers become their own bosses, when they become a worker cooperative or whatever you want to call it, they have a different attitude towards their job. It's now really their job. They're no longer just 9 to 5, do my job, go home, get a beer, watch TV. They know, for example, that if they're leaving the plant and the light is on in the bathroom, they'll stop for a minute and they'll flick the switch and turn the light off. Why? Because saving money on the electricity improves the finances of their own company. Americans like to tell each other the story. You'll maintain your apartment better if you own it, if it's yours, if you're not just a passing tenant, an occasional.
I agree with you, but not if I get the apartment free.
No free.
I need to pay for it. So if Absolutely. if I'm an employee, then am I buying into the company?
Yes.
So exactly. I'm paying my way in.
That's right.
Why can't they do that now?
They do it now. If we were more honest about our education.
Yeah, you don't need to be polite on this show.
You need to be polite with us.
Okay. If things were a bit more honest, we would be teaching our people in our schools and in our media and in our public life that there are alternatives, that we can in fact look at how they work and measure them and compare the efficiency if workers own and operate their own enterprise from how they behave and what they do when a tiny group of people who are not accountable to them make all the decisions.
But what you're saying could happen right now.
It is already happening. I can show you examples in the United States and around the world. I can go through them with you now where this has been done and we have a track record. This is not pie in the sky or some fancy utopia. This is what's going on now, and that's why I'm relatively confident that the difficulties we're having with the way we've organized it is opening people's minds to alternatives that at least we should discuss now, and in my own humble opinion, we should have been discussing for the last 50 years so we wouldn't be so far behind now. Would you like me to tell you about an example?
Sure.
All right. I'll pick the best one because I want to make the best case. The best one, I mean, there are others. I'll be glad to do others with you as well. The best example is a Spanish corporation in Spain. It's called the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation. Let me tell you very briefly how it emerged. It's 1956. Spain at that time, very poor country, has just come through a terrible civil war and World War II. So it's 1956 in the north of Spain, which was traditionally a poor area. They're poorer than poor. Okay, it's a Catholic country. A Catholic priest named Father Arizmendi in the town of Mondragon, that's right near the Pyrenees Mountain that separates Spain from France, he gives a famous speech in his church. And he says to the assembled people, if we wait for some capitalist employer to come here to give us a job, we will all die of old age before it happens. Everybody giggles. He says, so the only way for us to make progress economically is if we become our own employers. Let's do it ourselves. And he starts with six members of his Catholic parish in that town, 1956. Now, fast forward to right now. The Mondragon Cooperative Corporation has grown from six workers to roughly 110,000 workers. It is the most successful example of worker co-ops in the world. It is actually a family of about 200, 250 independent co-ops that are all under the one corporate umbrella. It is the seventh largest corporation in all of Spain because of its size. It has a number of partners. You might be interested in two American partners. Why? Because it has laboratories to develop new products that are state-of-the-art. And two American corporations pay this worker co-op for the right to their scientists working in their labs over there in Spain. The two American companies, Microsoft and General Motors, just to show you the confidence they have in this company. All right, along the way, they competed with private capitalist companies. Some owned privately, some owned publicly through the usual share process. They outcompeted them. That's why they grew from 6 to 110 or 120,000. They have some interesting rules. Once a year, the workers get together to decide whether they're pleased with the supervisors. If they are, the supervisors stay. If they aren't, the supervisors go. It's not the supervisors who hire the workers, it's the other way around. Here's another example. They decide how to distribute the profits that this company makes. Okay, they have a rule they pass. The highest paid worker cannot earn more than 8.5 times what the lowest paid worker. That's a rule. They made that the rule, they decided on that. They don't give everybody the same amount of money. As you can see, they give some people 8.5 times more than other people. But if you compare that to the ratio of a CEO to the lowest paid worker in a large American corporation, the ratio is more like 300-1. So they claim they have done something about the inequality of income and wealth in their society that we dream about in this society, and they did it by means of changing the way they organize their enterprises.
They've also limited themselves so that they can't hire the top talent to run their company.
That only assumes that the top talent is not available for them. They would argue they got the top talent, which is why they have the history and the record they can show.
I think that's probably, I recognize the exception of it.
If you hired me, you know, I have been, job seekers have come to me and talked to me, and they've asked me, where do you want to work? How do you want to work? Stuff like that. The answer I give them, and I think it's true of most people, is not just about the money. I'm interested in the conditions of work, how I interact with other people there, what the kind of growth path they envision might look like, what the kind of changes they see coming down the pike look like. And you know something? If I were told that I was part of a different way of running an enterprise, I actually think, in my case, and I don't think I'm a freak, I'd be intrigued by that. I'd be interested in trying that sort of thing. And you know, the reason is the same, and I think it's very American. I don't like to have a small number of people at the top telling me what to do. I don't like it politically, but I don't like it in my job either. I actually believe, I really do, that people have lots of insights, lots of understanding. I don't want a few people making all the decisions so everybody else either doesn't count or doesn't care after a while to pay enough attention to bring their creativity, their ingenuity. I don't want to live like that. I think this is a better way.
All right, we're going to take just a quick break here, and we're going to be right back to wrap up this segment.
Let me take a minute here to talk to you about dry mouth. You know, that sticky, dehydrated feeling that can leave your mouth cracked and sore? It's uncomfortable, for sure, but you know that having dry mouth can also lead to other oral health problems. And for many of us, dry mouth is actually caused by the medications we take, so it's really hard to avoid. Popular mouthwashes can make the problem even worse, especially if they have alcohol. And rinses that are supposed to help with dry mouth often leave you with a bad aftertaste and bad breath. The good news is my favorite mouthwash brand, Smart Mouth, has an all-day clean breath formula designed specifically to help those of us with dry mouth. Smart Mouth Dry Mouth Formula has exclusive moisture lock technology, along with activated bad breath protection that lasts for 12 hours. So with just two easy rinses a day, you get 24 hours of clean breath and relief from that sticky, thirsty, dry mouth feeling. Smart Mouth comes in a neat dual chamber bottle, so it combines to activate right when you pour it for the most effective protection you can get against bad breath. And like all of the products we talk about on this show, Smart Mouth is guaranteed. So pick up Smart Mouth Dry Mouth Formula in the purple and white bottle at Walmart, Walgreens, CVS Pharmacy, Rite Aid, and most other stores.
So Professor, picking back up on where you were just at, I get what you're saying here. I still think there's some limitations to the top talent, but I think what's going to happen is the top talent, the people that have the most skills, aren't they going to become entrepreneurs? Or are you suggesting that entrepreneurship needs to follow this pattern?
No, I would guess that entrepreneurship is one of those things we would want to encourage. I think you want to find all of the clever new ideas that people have about how to produce things or what new things ought to be produced in the first place. And I think any society worth its salt should create incentives and rewards for people who come up with those interesting, clever, progressive, in the broad sense of the term, ideas. Ooh. But I think I want to separate.
You just hit Hegel right on the nose, man.
Yeah, I want to, that's good. I want to, very professorial. I want to separate the incentive and reward to the entrepreneur, which I believe in, from how you organize in a company that's already doing whatever it is it's doing.
Okay, so as an entrepreneur, I'm an entrepreneur. So as an entrepreneur, I believe that I have an idea. I have a secret. I have a secret that I know how to do something better than someone else.
Gotcha.
That's what makes a real entrepreneur.
Here's the difference between Mark and I. I'm a horse. He's a jockey.
So,
well, my wife's a psychotherapist, and you need some help in burnishing up your image, your self-image.
I am what I am. I've been a horse all my life. I was a horse at NBC. I was a horse at Warner Brothers. I was a horse. They rode me and made lots of money. It was okay.
They rode hard and put
it was
wet.
A good horse.
I hope they shared it with you.
Absolutely. I negotiated with them.
But as an entrepreneur, I think I have a secret. I think I know a better way to make something. I start a business. I risk my capital. So I bet, and literally, I have bet my house. I have done all these things in the past.
Right.
Betting that I'm right. Okay.
Right.
Now, is it your position that the workers who work for that organization should vote on me? Should be telling me whether I should be the boss or not?
No, my feeling is that we ought to let you form a company, explore what you figured out, see if you can pull it off and make it a success. And once you can, then at that point, when we have tested, in a sense, you, and you've tested yourself to see whether it's a viable, effective, better alternative than somebody else, give you rewards for having proved it, give you rewards for having taken the risk. But we can do that without denying the workers that work with you their democratic rights to participate in the decisions that they have to live with.
But don't they have the democratic right to say they don't want to work for me anymore?
Yeah, but that's way less of a right than what they ought to. We don't say to people, I mean, some of us do, but I never liked it. We don't say to people who are critical of a decision made by Donald Trump as president or by Barack Obama as president, okay, you always can leave the United States. That's not much. That's not much of a freedom. Yeah, I can do it.
But being able to get a different job's a lot easier.
But maybe. But if we don't give them democratic rights anywhere else, if we don't have these worker co-ops that they can move to, then we're basically saying you can be undemocratically employed in this place, and if you don't like it, you have the big fat freedom to go to another place where you will also be denied those rights.
Here's what I'm not understanding. I go and I risk everything I have. I work 24 hours a day, 10 years, I pull this off, I build this business, I have all this, all these people, and now I should only be able to make 8 times what the person on the bottom should make?
Yeah, if that's a democratic rule of the community that you work with, these are the people you brought in, these are the people you think can help make your dreams come true, realize your invention, make success out of your entrepreneurship. By the way, those workers, to be fair, they've also risked something. They've also moved into a house, taken out a mortgage, undertook to have another kid, or whatever decisions they made.
But I didn't contribute to those decisions.
Excuse me? Sure you did.
No, I didn't tell them to go buy a house or have a kid.
No, but you offered them a job. And you offered them a job which took the risk that maybe you were wrong. In which case, they went to work, they made a decision, just like you did to invest your money, you risked your money, they risked all the decisions they made, you weren't forced to risk your money, they weren't forced to take the job. But that doesn't deny that you took a risk, and they took a risk.
But they got a paycheck every Friday, maybe I didn't.
Well, you know, my guess is you
didn't take the risk.
You took the risk. Who knows what they gave up to come to work in your place? Who knows? If you knew, we could have this conversation. My guess is, as a person who's not an entrepreneur, I took a risk. When I took a job at the University of Massachusetts, I took a risk to live in that part of the country, to invest in a house with my wife. I got 2 kids, et cetera, et cetera. If that university had closed, if that university had changed direction, if that university had decided what I teach is not what they want, I would have been out to lunch there. I would have taken a risk and it wouldn't have worked out.
But what about the person who is working at Target in retail and they decide I'm going to leave Target, I'm going to go get a job at Walmart?
Right.
Okay. How much risk was involved? They're not going to relocate. They're not going to buy another house. They're going to go from this street 2 blocks over to the other street because they're making another 50 cents an hour, let's say.
Well, you know,
where's the risk that they took?
The risk that they took is they are now subject to an employer who can at any time say, we're done with you. We have a robot. We have a computer. We're closing this store. All the decisions that you don't control entail your risk. You took a risk.
But if I have a robot, let me go there for a minute. Let's take McDonald's. So McDonald's has been getting rid of the front counter people. McDonald's and Wendy's are getting rid of the counter people and replacing them with kiosk now.
Right.
So all those jobs are going away.
Right.
Now those kiosks are faster. Those kiosks are infinitely more accurate. And they never get sick, and they always come to work, and they save money.
Right.
Doesn't it make sense for the company, for the benefit of the company, and the benefit of the consumer, who now gets a more accurate order with less cost to the company, which means the product can be sold cheaper? Isn't bringing in that automation the right thing to do, and wouldn't those workers vote against the automation?
My guess is the workers would either vote against the automation or, and here's the option I find so remarkably absent in our economy, we would say, good, we have a technical innovation that improves things for the consumer, the way you describe it, improves profits for the company. Tell me why it doesn't also improve conditions for the worker, one way or another.
It reduces the number of workers.
We would have a much happier society if when we have a technical breakthrough, it benefits all the people with stakes in the outcome.
And ultimately, it does.
Let me narrow this down to something. And you
ultimately is a hard sell to the guy who's just been fired.
Well, I mean, you take a look, Chuck, give me a second. If you go back in history and we look at the Reaper when the combine came in.
Right.
And when that, you know the story. So when that machine came in, that machine replaced what, 20 farm workers with each machine. And they were cutting trees down and blocking highways and trying to stop, you know, these machines from coming in. It sent a lot of people home who never worked again.
Right.
But the next generation realized we're not going to be farmers. We're going to do something else.
But they realized that not out of a conversation that said, hey, we don't need this many people doing this kind of work because we figured out a machine. So let's get together and figure out another way to use your time. Maybe to give you a little bit of leisure that you never had before, maybe to train you into something else, maybe to move you. We didn't do that. We told them, you're fired, screw you. We don't care what happens to you, your spouse, your children, your community. You're just going to be thrown on the slag heap. All I'm saying is, we don't have to do that. We don't have to limit the benefits of technology to the profits of a corporation and even to the consumer when they get a benefit. We can also include in that the workers who are affected, because you know what? That will get us a real advance. They won't be in the street to stop it. They won't see technology as their enemy because you didn't make it as their enemy because it doesn't have to be their enemy. We don't think it through. So what we do is we screw a bunch of people and then we claim we're surprised that they're not pleased with the progress. If you don't want them to be the enemies of progress, which they shouldn't be, then don't put them in that position. We could do that.
Okay. Now, let me say my say. Okay? Now the
voice of
reason. By the way, gentlemen, really, seriously, this is good. This is what we should be talking about.
I'm dropped the reins and I'm hanging onto the saddle horn, okay? So okay. Give me a break. As the jockey, I've just changed.
You just changed. You stopped being the horse.
I just jumped on the horse and I'm not the horse anymore. Here's the deal. What you say, let's say it works all the time. It's great. It's fabulous. Any corporation could take this model and run with it, correct? Any corporation could do that. Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay. So it's a free choice. Whether you decide to do this and it works for you, fine. If you don't think it works for you, that's another thing. So here's my question. Are you saying that government should step in and command every corporation to follow this model and we would be better off for it? Or do corporations have the free choice to try this, work at it, see if it works for them? And if it does, others will follow.
I like the second one better than the first one. I'm not, just like you, I'm not interested in the government coming in.
So you stay in a free market, people can decide what they want to do, corporations can decide if they want to try this, if it works for them.
Well, let me give you an example of a country that's actually moving on, doing in a practical way what your question opens up. The government in question is the government in Britain, Great Britain, United Kingdom. The polls in England right now, in Britain right now, show that the likely next government will be what they call there the Labour Party. It's a rough equivalent to our Democratic Party, because they call the rough equivalent to our Republican Party over there is the Conservative Party.
The Labour Party is the left and the Conservative Party is the right.
Exactly. So the Labour Party is now, the polls are looking that they're likely going to be in. So here's what their proposal is. Every company in England, in Britain, can stay the way it is for as long as it wants, end of story. If it likes to stay the way it is, conventional capitalist company, fine. It can do that. But under the law, which they're committed to pass if they get voted in, the law, they will pass two laws. One, any company that decides either to close itself or to sell itself to another company or to go public by shares or to move to another part of the world will have to first, before it does those actions, free to do them, but before it does that, it must give what's called right of first refusal to its own workers to take the company over, to buy the company and convert it into a worker co-op. And the argument why they're going to do that is, in order for there to be a free choice of the British people between the old system and this new worker cooperative system, there have to be worker cooperatives so people can see them, see what it's like to buy from them, see what it's like to work in them, and all of that. Otherwise, there isn't a free choice. And so this law will say, if the workers want to, and if the workers can get the money to, they can buy the companies, convert them, and then we can have the debate and the discussion and the choice about which way our society goes. Second law they're going to pass. Any workers will be able to go to the government to get a loan to do exactly that. And that's the commitment of the government, not to force a change, but to give the people a chance to see what these cooperatives are, how they work, and then make the kind of choice of what mixture of the two they like. That's the plan. I think that makes a lot of sense.
That could be the student loan program on steroids. So let me ask you a question. It is the nature of the management of corporations to act in their own self-interest, correct?
Absolutely.
And it is the self-interest of the managers of a corporation to make decisions that will allow the company to flourish.
Well,
so that the company has the ability.
They don't agree and we don't agree on what flourish means.
Well, I'm going to say flourish means that the company grows, that the company makes more profits.
Well, there's a lot of managements, including several that I have been with, where the major goal is to enhance the management's salary and perks, or the major goal is to have a better stock price. It's complicated what managements do. They are conflicted amongst themselves. If you ever go to a management meeting, I mean, top management, the directors, they fight a lot over what it is the company should do.
But knowing that companies are always looking for a competitive edge, knowing that one of the biggest competitive edges that you can get in this particular society is to have the best people. And again, I'm not talking about fast food, but where you need people that have got serious talent, you want to have the perks and have the things that will attract that talent.
Yes.
Knowing all these things, why are more companies not doing what you're saying? If it is an advantage, why are they not doing it? Because why isn't Google doing this?
It's sort of like asking me the question, why did the kings of England not voluntarily, or kings of anywhere, not voluntarily give up the throne and go over to a electoral parliamentary system? People with power have a hard time giving it up and can come up with lots of reasons why it's not a good idea for the institutions they run to have any other system than the one they're sitting on top of. I don't find that a terribly persuasive rationale.
But what you're saying is, let's say Google was to do this. If Google was to do this, then the top management and owners at Google would ultimately have to accept they're going to make a lot less money.
Probably, yes. My guess is democratically you would not allow, well, let's take Amazon. You would not allow one person to have $100 billion of personal wealth, making him richer than most of the countries on this planet, because you wouldn't have divided the wealth that was created by all of Amazon's workers in such a way to make one person off the chart like that. You wouldn't do that. Mr. Bezos would have trouble.
But the one person is the one person who came up with the idea, implemented it, and took the risk.
Even Mr. Bezos doesn't claim that. Why do you?
Well, it's interesting because Mr. Bezos is a leftist, is he not? Would you agree with that?
He is. He's politically, he is a leftist, but yeah. Not when it comes to his money.
Not when it comes to the money. Exactly right.
He's a selective. Yeah, it's a
well, I mean, it's
but the guys at Google are too.
These people who are kind of, you know, on the left, Berkshire Hathaway, you just go down the list, they're all capitalists at heart.
Right, except when it gets to they're capitalists when it's their money, but they're liberals when it comes to everything else that they want
to. Very
even though I normally attack her, I don't defend him. Let me defend for a minute both Bezos and Buffett for a minute, right? Bezos, to his credit, understands, and he'd be a real, he'd be a liar if he didn't, but he does understand, so he doesn't deserve that label. He understands that his ideas about how to build Amazon are actually the ideas of loads of other people. The teachers who taught him in school, the parents who raised him, the friends he had along the way, the books he read, the associates in the company. You know, if you work closely with other people, which he prides himself for having done, it becomes very difficult to decide who had what idea when. It's a collective operation. The idea that I can separate out which part I did is kind of an arrogance that these sorts of folks, to their credit, don't exhibit. Now, Mr. Buffett, for a minute, he was fair enough to say, you remember the story he told, I think it was a couple of years ago, when he pointed out that the tax rate he paid on his income was lower than the tax rate paid by his secretary in his office. And so he wanted taxes to be changed so to get rid of that situation. Either he should be raised to the level of the secretary or she should be lowered to his, but it was insane for a multi-billionaire to be taxed, in his mind, at the same rate, actually at a lower rate than his secretary was. So even he and Bezos are able, at least on occasions, to recognize that the rationale for what they're enjoying is something they couldn't, as a principle, endorse.
Except when we look at Warren Buffett is paying less taxes because Warren Buffett is falling under a capital gains tax and his secretary is falling under an income tax.
Exactly.
So without explaining that, it sounds like it's like rich people get lower taxes.
But,
it happens to be what they do.
The rich people who pay the lobbyists to get the capital gains.
But only on the capital gains. But why doesn't Warren Buffett just write a check for the difference and send it to the Office of Management, Parkersburg, West Virginia?
Well, to be, again, I'm in this awful, weird position of defending Mr. Buffett, which I don't want to do. But to be fair to him, he thinks it's a social issue, and he's right. You don't solve a social issue with a personal check.
Can't he lead by example?
He could lead by example. He could do what he could use the model you're talking about if he wanted to.
Absolutely. And he's not doing it because he does not believe in that kind of a change. And I'm not surprised.
There's another thing here that Jeff Bezos and Warren Buffett and people like that on the left who apologize to the left for their great wealth are then immune from being attacked by the left, which I find fascinating.
Because you apologize for it.
That's right.
I can assure you that I have done my share of attacking both gentlemen, which is why I find this conversation a little unusual.
Listen, we really appreciate you being on the show today. We really do, Richard. This has been fun. It's been really fun.
And so, I want to say it for myself, too. I enjoy talking with you. I like your questions.
Thank you.
I want to say again.
You have to grade us, Professor.
We have the kindest. This is the kind of discussion, back and forth, that we need in the country. That's the only way we're going to sort out this mess. Otherwise, we're going to be wallowing in this regime, that regime, this president who's going to solve it all and then disappoints us, and the next one repeats the game. This is what has to happen. This has not happened for the last 50 years. So my hat's off to you guys.
Well, thank you. You know, we are divided people and divided government. I always love it when people come on and say, well, our government is so divided. Give me a time in history when it wasn't.
No, that's
We've right. always been divided. So.
And it's healthy. That's a healthy thing.
Right.
Thank
but
you
what
so
we
much
need to do is have
on.
Conversations like this where people are not calling each other names and not,
right.
not right, just exploring different ideas. I hope you'll come back because this was great.
Yeah. I had a good time. You invite me back, I'll be here.
You have to give us a grade. You have to do it.
And just so people know, you have a website, rdwolf.com. That's WOLFF.com. And you also have democracyatwork.info, correct?
That's right. Both of those are available 24/7, no charge. You can find out much more about all this stuff.
And we will have links on the show notes at Blunt Force Truth, where you can find Dr. Richard Wolf.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. And I hope we do it again.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Well, Chuck.
Well, Mark.
That's Dr. Wolf. That was fun.
That was different. I mean, the only thing was I kept hearing words like collective
and Hegel
and progressive, you know. So, well, it's interesting. I couldn't quite get a fix on him until toward the end there. And I could be wrong. I hate to, you know, to judge a guest, but it sounded more left and right.
Yeah, the true colors came out as we started talking about, you know, top people can only make eight times what the bottom people make. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he's a very nice guy.
He's a very nice guy.
He's very bright.
Right. Well, you know, who am I to say he's bright? He's got PhDs coming out his ears.
He obviously is a gentleman who's I think, very attached to the idea of, I mean, he says it's not socialism, but it is socialism of a nature. It's collectivism.
Which is socialism, yeah.
And obviously he has kind of a redistribution of wealth kind of.
It takes a village.
So I'll tell you what's different about him. I think what's different about him is I believe he's approaching his redistribution from the right place as far as where his heart's at.
Well, look, you know, I was trying to sum it up and say, here we are in America. Any corporation, any business, if his model is so good and competitive, then any corporation can switch and go over to that model and go away with whatever model they've got. So it's free choice. That's all I was asking is the government doesn't get involved and tell us you have to do this model, which I think is what he was talking about when you came to Britain. Britain's now, you know, it's
you're going to dictate it.
It's been Keynesian for, you know, since the 30s. So, or at least the 40s. I think it was Keynesian. It really turned Keynesian after the Second World War. So anyway, that's that. And
and that's why I asked him the question, you know, why aren't, if this is so wonderful, why aren't corporations doing it?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we'd all be flocking to do this, but the reality is no one's going to invest in a company where you can't have the upside of the return.
No, it's about money.
Right. It's not going to happen. It doesn't work, but it certainly sounds really nice.
Well, it's interesting too, when he said, you know, I'd be offered a job, money really isn't what I'm thinking about. I want to know how I interact with the people, what the environment is, something like that. Well, that may be true for him, but I'm not so sure that's true for everyone or for even the majority. Usually money is the incentive, unless it's along the lines of your profession and you want to be in your profession, you'll take whatever comes.
And so you bring up a really good point because you're talking about a professor who any offer he's going to get anywhere in the country is going to have six digits attached to it.
And tenure and all kinds of things. Yeah.
And that's different for the guy who's making $10 an hour, $15 an hour.
Right.
The guy making $10 an hour gets an offer of a job at $12 an hour. Is he really that focused on his coworkers and whether they have a lunch program?
I don't want to be fair to him. I mean, he certainly has every right to believe what he believes. He's a smart guy. I think that his attachment to a progressive point of view with collectivism and so on is, you know, it's his right. And I appreciate that. And I hope he'll come back.
I had fun with him. I thought it was great, and I thought he was a great guy. Well, anyways, that wraps it up for today's show. If you enjoyed it, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, leave us a positive review.
And we'll see you next time on Blunt Force Truth.